Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So I came across recently something on the internet that looked like it was a spoof. It's a thing called a family bed. And I'm always cribbing about the size of our bed that my wife and I share. How wide is our bed? 140 centimeters. This has been a sore subject in our marriage. But we don't have, it is a fantastically comfortable mattress, and we don't currently have room for anything wider. But we will, we do aspire to have a wider bed at some point. But these family beds really take it to the next level. I'm looking at a photograph of, it says, family beds are massive, oversized mattresses, typically 240 centimeters to 360 centimeters. Or 9 to 12 feet wide. I think that's pretty much as wide as this entire room that I'm recording this podcast from. So Herman and Corin, this concept of the family bed, which I didn't know such a thing exists, but my wife is exposed to all sorts of interesting interior design projects through her work. But co-sleeping, it seems like these are things intended for co-sleeping, which I recall reading is the science is that it's generally a really bad idea. That was when Ezra was in his first few months. We were always making sure that we keep awake so that we don't fall asleep, because you're running on fumes sometimes, especially if you're the only carers for a young one. But I always thought about co-sleeping that there was some, like, a later point in time you could occasionally do that. I mean, it's very useful when you want to have, like, a nap, and that feeling that you have to stay awake and you can't doze off, you're having some, like, quality time with your little one, and that's great. But if you know that you absolutely have to stay awake, it kind of takes the relaxation out of it. So Herman and Corin would love to chat about this topic, not just of the family bed, because it seems like there's a whole, this thing is crazy. I'm looking at the photograph, and there's literally six or seven people pictured in this. I mean, that seems like very weird to me from just kind of a privacy standpoint, that you'd want to do that regularly, but I guess there is a demand for it. There's literally entire websites. This is, again, stuff that I would have never guessed existed. Fambed.co.uk, Fambed, the original family bed for co-sleeping. So there's specialist retailers, there's a whole industry apparently of people who buy gigantic beds to literally fit their whole family. But at the less extreme side of this, Herman and Corin, is co-sleeping a blanket? Don't ever do that. Don't ever have a nap. Or is there flexibility once they're at a certain age? Let's talk about this important topic. And we also have to talk about SIDS, because even though no one really wants to think about, God forbid, young ones dying, a lot of these recommendations for safety are in place because of stuff like suffocation and SIDS. So let's talk about safe sleeping with infants, Herman and Corin, and family beds in today's episode of My Weird Prompts.
You know, it is funny how our housemate Daniel always finds these niche topics that end up being way more complex than they look on the surface. He was telling me about his struggle with a 140 centimeter bed, which, for our American listeners, is about 55 inches, roughly a double or full-size bed. And then he sends us this prompt about the family bed. These massive 360 centimeter mattresses.
Herman Poppleberry here, and let me tell you, I have been down a rabbit hole on this one. When Daniel mentioned the family bed, I initially thought it was just a marketing gimmick for people with way too much bedroom floor space. But it turns out there is a whole philosophy behind it, deeply intertwined with the concept of attachment parenting and co-sleeping.
It is quite a leap from a cramped double bed to a 12-foot wide mattress. But the safety aspect is what really caught my eye in Daniel's prompt. We have all heard the warnings about sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, and the dangers of bed sharing. It feels like there is this massive tension between the biological instinct to keep your children close and the medical advice that says it is potentially lethal.
Exactly. And that is where we need to start, because the terminology here is often used interchangeably, but it really should not be. Co-sleeping is the umbrella term. It just means sleeping in close proximity to your infant. That includes room sharing, where the baby is in a separate crib or bassinet in the same room, and bed sharing, where the baby is actually on the same sleeping surface as the parents.
Right. And the medical consensus on those two things is wildly different. The American Academy of Pediatrics, or the AAP for instance, updated their guidelines recently to strongly recommend room sharing for at least the first 6 months. They found it can reduce the risk of SIDS by as much as 50%. But they are very firm on the stance that bed sharing, especially in the first 4 months, is a significant risk factor.
They are, and for good reason, based on the data. When we look at SIDS and SUID, which is sudden unexpected infant death, the risks in a shared bed often come down to three main factors: suffocation, entrapment, and overheating. Adult mattresses are usually much softer than infant mattresses. If a baby rolls over or if their face is pressed into a soft surface, they cannot always clear their airway. Then you have pillows, heavy blankets, and the parents themselves.
The overlay risk is the one that really terrifies people. The idea of a parent accidentally rolling onto the child. But Herman, I have seen some researchers argue that if the parents are breastfeeding and not under the influence of alcohol or medication, they have a heightened physiological awareness of the baby. Is there actual data to support that, or is it more of a hopeful theory?
It is a bit of both, but mostly it comes down to the research of James McKenna. He ran the Mother-Baby Behavioral Sleep Laboratory at Notre Dame. His research into what he calls breast sleeping showed that breastfeeding mothers and their infants actually coordinate their sleep cycles and their physiological states. The mothers tend to sleep in a protective C-shaped position around the baby, and they wake up more frequently to check on the infant.
That C-shaped position is interesting. The mother is on her side, knees tucked up under the baby's feet, and her arm above the baby's head. It basically creates a little protected cove. But even with that, the AAP still says the risk of the mattress itself or the bedding is too high for newborns.
And that is the crucial point. Even if the parent is a perfect light sleeper, an adult bed is not designed for an infant. Think about the gaps between the mattress and the headboard, or the mattress and the wall. A tiny infant can get wedged in there, which is what we call entrapment, or a heavy duvet can accidentally cover the baby's face. Infants do not have the motor skills to pull a blanket off themselves if they are struggling to breathe.
So, if we look at the family bed concept, which Daniel mentioned is sometimes 360 centimeters wide, that is massive. That is like 12 feet of bed. In theory, does that extra space mitigate some of the risks, or does it just create more surface area for problems?
It is an interesting trade-off. On one hand, more space means less chance of a parent accidentally rolling onto the child. If you have a 12-foot-wide bed, like the one sold by the Ace Collection or Taylor & Wells, you can realistically have the baby in their own clear zone. But the fundamental problem of the mattress firmness remains. Most high-end adult mattresses, especially those oversized ones, are designed for adult comfort, meaning they have pillow tops or memory foam that contours to the body. For an infant, that contouring is exactly what you do not want, because it can create a pocket of exhaled carbon dioxide around their face.
Right. The carbon dioxide rebreathing. That is a technical detail people often miss. It is not just about physical blockage. It is about the baby breathing back in the air they just exhaled, which lowers their oxygen levels and can lead to a failure in their arousal mechanism. Basically, they just do not wake up when they should.
Exactly. And this leads to the question of age. Daniel asked if there is more flexibility once a child reaches a certain age. The risk of SIDS peaks between 1 and 4 months and drops off significantly after 6 months. By the time a child is 1 year old, they generally have the strength and coordination to move their head, roll over, and push away blankets.
So, is 12 months the magic number where the family bed becomes a viable, safe option?
Most pediatricians would say that after 1 year, the risk of SIDS is nearly zero, and the risks of suffocation are dramatically lower. At that point, the discussion shifts from purely medical safety to things like sleep quality and behavioral development. But it is worth noting that even for a toddler, things like large gaps or very heavy, loose bedding can still be a hazard, just a much smaller one.
I want to pivot for a second to the cultural side of this. We are talking about this from a very Western, 21st century medical perspective. But if you look at human history, or even current practices in many parts of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, bed sharing is the norm. In some cultures, the idea of putting a baby in a separate room is considered almost cruel. Why is there such a massive disconnect between global cultural practices and Western medical advice?
That is a fantastic question, Korn, and it is something researchers have struggled to reconcile. It is often called the Asian paradox. For example, in Japan, bed sharing is extremely common, yet they have some of the lowest infant mortality rates in the world. When researchers looked into why, they found several factors. First, Japanese families traditionally sleep on very firm futons on the floor. No soft mattresses, no heavy duvets, and no high beds to fall off of.
So the environment is the key, not just the act of sharing the bed.
Exactly. Also, there are lower rates of maternal smoking and alcohol consumption in those specific study groups, which are two of the biggest risk factors for SIDS in a bed-sharing environment. When the Western medical community issues a blanket ban on bed sharing, it is often because they are looking at a population where adult beds are soft, duvets are heavy, and smoking or drinking might be present. In that specific environment, bed sharing is undeniably dangerous.
It is about the risk profile of the average Western bedroom. I mean, if you look at the typical bed in a house in the United States, or even here in Jerusalem, it is full of hazards for an infant. We love our plush pillows and our thick comforters.
We really do. And that is why the family bed products Daniel saw are so fascinating. They are trying to productize a cultural practice that traditionally happened on a simple, firm mat. When you buy a 360-centimeter mattress, you are trying to buy your way into a lifestyle of closeness. But you are doing it with modern, Western luxury standards, which might be at odds with the original safety of the practice.
Let us talk about the logistics of these giant beds. I was looking at some of the websites Daniel mentioned, like fanbed.co.uk. They sell these modular systems. It is essentially two or three mattresses joined together with a giant topper and custom sheets. Can you imagine trying to change the sheets on a 12-foot bed?
It sounds like a workout. But honestly, for families who practice attachment parenting, the appeal is obvious. If you have a toddler who wakes up in the middle of the night and a newborn who needs to nurse, having everyone in one giant safe space sounds a lot better than the game of musical chairs many parents play at 3 in the morning.
It is the musical beds phenomenon. One parent ends up on the sofa, the toddler is sideways in the king bed, and the baby is in a bassinet. I can see why a 12-foot wide mattress looks like a solution, but Herman, what about the psychological side? There is always this argument that if you let kids in your bed, they will never leave, and they will not learn to self-soothe. What does the research say about long-term independence?
This is a hotly debated area, but the most recent longitudinal studies actually suggest the opposite of what people fear. Children who co-sleep in a safe, supportive environment often grow up to be more independent and have higher self-esteem. The theory is that by having their needs for closeness met consistently early on, they develop a secure attachment, which gives them the confidence to explore the world as they get older.
That makes sense. It is the idea that you cannot spoil a baby with too much affection. But I think the transition out of the family bed is where the friction happens. If you have been in a 12-foot bed with your parents for 4 years, moving to a twin bed in a dark room by yourself is a huge shock.
It definitely requires a transition plan. But back to Daniel's point about safety. If someone is listening and they are thinking, okay, I want to do this, but I want to be safe, what are the non-negotiables? We have talked about the 1-year mark being a major turning point, but what if they have an infant and they are struggling with sleep deprivation?
This is where we have to talk about the Safe Sleep 7. This is a set of criteria developed by the La Leche League to help breastfeeding mothers minimize the risks if they do end up bed sharing, even if it is accidental due to exhaustion.
Right. Let us go through them because they are very specific. The first three are about the mother. She should be a non-smoker, she must be sober, meaning no alcohol or drugs that cause drowsiness, and she should be a breastfeeding mother. The breastfeeding part is important because it changes the mother's sleep architecture and positioning.
and the next four are about the baby and the environment. The baby should be healthy and full term, placed on their back to sleep, and lightly dressed so they do not overheat. Then the surface itself must be safe. That means a firm mattress. No soft pillows near the baby, no heavy blankets, and no gaps where the baby could get stuck.
And that last one is the hardest to achieve in a modern home. Most people think their mattress is firm, but by infant safety standards, it usually is not. If you press your hand down and it leaves an indentation or the fabric bunches up, it is too soft.
This is why some people who are really committed to the family bed concept actually ditch the traditional mattress entirely and go with high-density foam or even firm floor mats. It is a commitment to a different kind of comfort.
It really is. And I think we should address the elephant in the room, which is the impact on the parents' relationship. Daniel mentioned the privacy aspect. If you have a 360-centimeter bed with two or three children in it, the husband and wife dynamic changes.
You are not just roommates with your kids. You are literally bunkmates. I have read forums where parents who use family beds say they have to be very intentional about finding time for each other outside of the bedroom. It is a lifestyle choice that prioritizes the family unit over the traditional couple-centric household.
It is a radical shift in how we think about the home. In the West, we have this idea of the nursery as this curated, separate kingdom for the child. But that is a relatively recent historical development, mostly arising with the middle class in the 19th century. Before that, everyone was pretty much in the same room, if not the same bed, for warmth and safety.
So, in a way, the family bed is a return to a more ancestral way of living, just scaled up with modern manufacturing. But I keep coming back to the danger for newborns. It feels like the safest middle ground is the sidecar bassinet. You know, those three-sided cribs that attach directly to the side of the parent's bed?
Those are a great compromise. They give the baby their own firm, clear sleeping surface, which eliminates the overlay and suffocation risks of the adult bed. But the mother can still reach out and touch the baby or pull them in for nursing without having to get out of bed. It provides that proximity and the physiological benefits McKenna talked about without the physical hazards of the adult mattress.
If I were giving advice to Daniel or anyone in his position, that would be my recommendation for the first year. Use a sidecar. It gives you that feeling of a larger bed without the risk. And then, once the child is older, maybe 14 or 18 months, then you can talk about the giant 12-foot mattress if you really want to.
I agree. The risk-to-reward ratio for bed sharing with a newborn is just too high in a typical Western setup, but I do not think we should shame parents who do it. Often, it is a result of sheer desperation. If you have a baby who only sleeps when held, and you are so tired you are hallucinating, falling asleep in a bed is almost inevitable.
That is a really important point, Herman. Sleep deprivation is a safety risk in itself. A parent who is hallucinating from lack of sleep is more likely to have an accident, whether that is dropping the baby or having a car crash. Sometimes, creating the safest possible bed-sharing environment is actually safer than a parent trying to stay awake on a sofa with a baby.
Oh, the sofa is the absolute worst place. That is a huge point. If you are tired, never ever feed the baby on a sofa or an armchair. The risk of the baby getting wedged between you and the cushions is significantly higher than in a bed. If you think you might fall asleep, get into a clear, firm bed.
So, let us summarize the safety evolution here. Birth to 6 months, room sharing is the gold standard. A separate firm surface like a crib or a sidecar bassinet right next to the bed. 6 to 12 months, still safer on their own surface, but the risks are beginning to decrease as they get more mobile.
And then after 12 months, you are in the clear for the most part regarding SIDS. At that point, the family bed becomes a matter of preference and logistics. But you still have to watch out for things like the bed being too high off the ground. If a toddler falls out of a tall bed onto a hard floor, that is a real injury risk.
Which is why those family beds are often designed to be very low to the ground, or even just mattresses on a low platform. It is all about mitigating the specific risks of each developmental stage.
I am curious, Korn, what do you think about the trend itself? Do you think we are going to see more of these 360-centimeter beds, or is this a peak internet fad thing?
I think it is part of a larger trend toward what people call slow living or intentional parenting. People are pushing back against the idea that everything needs to be segmented and efficient. They want more connection. But practically speaking, most people do not have a bedroom big enough for a 12-foot bed. My bedroom here in Jerusalem definitely could not fit one. I would have to remove the closet and maybe the door.
Yeah, I think the housing market is the biggest enemy of the family bed. But it is fascinating to see companies catering to it. It shows there is a real demand for a different way of organizing family life.
There is also the cost factor. I looked it up, and some of these setups can cost $5,000 or $6,000 by the time you get the custom frame, the multiple mattresses, and the oversized linens. That is a huge investment in the sleep philosophy.
It really is. But if it means the whole family gets 8 hours of sleep instead of 4, some people would say that is priceless. I mean, look at Daniel. He is complaining about a 140-centimeter bed. If he upgraded to a 360-centimeter one, he would have so much room he might not even know his wife was in the bed with him.
He would need a GPS to find her. But in all seriousness, I think the takeaway here is that safety is not a one-size-fits-all static rule. It is a set of principles that you have to apply to your specific situation. The American Academy of Pediatrics provides the safest baseline for the widest population, but understanding the why behind those rules allows parents to make more informed choices as their kids grow.
Exactly. It is about risk management. You move from a state of very high vulnerability with a newborn to a state of much higher resilience with a toddler. The family bed is a tool that can be used safely if you understand the mechanics of sleep environments.
And if you have the floor space. Do not forget the floor space.
Right. And a very large washing machine for those sheets. Can you imagine trying to dry a 12-foot wide fitted sheet? You would need a commercial laundry.
You would just have to hang it over the balcony and hope for a windy day. But hey, we have covered a lot of ground here, from the physiology of SIDS to the history of the Victorian nursery. It is a much deeper topic than I expected.
It always is with Daniel's prompts. There is always a layer of human behavior and science underneath the surface. I really enjoy digging into the McKenna research again. It is such a fascinating look at how our biology has not quite caught up with our modern housing.
It really has not. We are still essentially primates who want to huddle together for safety, living in houses designed for maximum individual privacy. The family bed is just a very expensive way to try and bridge that gap.
Well put. I think we should probably wrap this up before I start measuring my own room for a 12-foot mattress. I do not think my books would appreciate being moved to the hallway to make room for more bed.
I do not think they would. All right, I think that covers the essentials of safe sleeping and the phenomenon of the family bed. Hopefully, this gives Daniel some perspective on his 140-centimeter struggle. It could be worse, Daniel. You could be trying to fold a sheet the size of a small parachute.
Or you could be sleeping on a Japanese futon on the floor, which honestly sounds pretty good right now.
It does. Before we go, I want to say a quick thank you to all of you for listening. We have been doing this for over 500 episodes now, and the community around my weird prompts is just incredible. If you are enjoying these deep dives, please do us a huge favor and leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really does help other curious people find the show.
It really does. We read the reviews and we appreciate the feedback. It keeps us going.
You can find all our past episodes and a way to get in touch with us at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We are also on Spotify, so make sure to follow us there so you never miss an episode.
And thanks again to our housemate Daniel for sending this one in. It was a great excuse to look at the intersection of architecture, parenting, and biology.
Absolutely. This has been My Weird Prompts. I am Corn.
And I am Herman Pobbleberry.
We will talk to you next time.
Goodbye, everyone.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.